Hello, and welcome to Polity Matters. My name's Ben Ratliff, and soon you'll also hear the smooth, dulcet tones of Jared Nelson and Scott Edberg. This episode is a continuation of our previous discussion of BCO Chapter 13 on the Presbytery. If you haven't listened there, go back to Polity Matters number 30 to get caught up. Otherwise, jump in with us as we move along into BCO 13, Section 8. Let's move on to Paragraph 8. The Presbytery, before receiving into its membership any church, shall designate a commission to meet with the church's ruling elders to make certain that the elders understand and can sincerely adopt the doctrines and polity of the Presbyterian Church in America as contained in its constitution. In the presence of the commission, the ruling elders shall be required to answer affirmatively the questions required of officers at their ordination. So here we have a paragraph dealing with the other members of a presbytery. We've talked a lot about teaching elders and their transfers and movement in and around the presbytery. What about the churches that are members of the presbytery? And if some church wants to join a presbytery, what happens? I'm curious if you guys have experience with this process. I've never actually participated in something like this or seen it up close, but it's not dissimilar from having a man transfer his credentials as a teaching elder. You've got to go examine the elders involved and then have them agree to the questions asked at ordination and installation. What comes to mind? What stands out here to you guys?
I've been a part of this process in the Chicago Metro Presbytery, moving from the Reformed Church in America to the Presbyterian Church in America. And what it looked like was basically a presbytery exam for a candidate for ministry, except it was before a whole session of elders. And so the presbytery had a commission come down to Grace Church of Lansing, and they examined not only the teaching elders separately according to the provision we just discussed, but then actually examined the session itself. And it probably wasn't as difficult as the teaching elder exams, but they were examining whether they were Calvinists, what they believed on women's ordination. We were coming from the mainline Dutch tradition, so sexuality. They were questioned to make sure that the pastors weren't the ones merely driving the ship, but that this would actually be a good church for the PCA. Because, yeah, they might have a good pastor, but if that pastor leaves, then the church might be wayward, and who they call next might lead to trouble. And that was also perhaps some trouble that we did experience in Chicago Metro. That church I came out with is no longer PCA, because after the pastors left, it was readily found out that they weren't actually a really good fit. And so it is to seek to ensure that it's not merely a pastor thing, but that the church itself is a good fit for the Presbyterian Church in America. And I think it's wise to take that paragraph seriously.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. 13:9 is the longest part of this chapter.
And so I think nine.
Oh, no. There's only 13.
Nine is like 17 sections.
Scott's not wrong. It's long. And I think we'll just take it in pieces. So I'll read the beginning, sort of couple of sentences, and then we'll come back and touch on each subsequent, phrase and paragraph and make comments as we, desire. So 13:9 begins by saying the presbytery has power to receive and issue appeals, complaints, and references brought before it in an orderly manner. In cases in which the session cannot exercise its authority, it shall have power to assume original jurisdiction. And there's an editor's note that's just a footnote that explains at the top of this just means the presbytery has power to receive and issue or settle appeals, complaints, and references. So it has the ability to take care of these things as it comes to it, more or less. It's just supposed to handle those as they come to it. But can you guys talk about this idea of sessions not being able to exercise their own authority and the presbytery needing to assume original jurisdiction? What might be example situations of something like this?
Perhaps you have a church that has lost all of its ruling elders, or perhaps you have a church that just the ruling elders don't feel like they're able to handle a certain situation, or I've heard of disagreements where a session is not getting along with itself. And so either you have just two ruling elders, they can't agree. So they have to have presbytery intervene.
We talked last time about how if you get down to one ruling elder in a particular church, only one ruling elder, no teaching elder either, that he has the power to do a few things, right? He can kind of offer pastoral oversight and shepherd the people, but there are a lot of things he can't do because he's not a session in and of himself. And so in that point, the presbytery would need to come in and assume jurisdiction and take care of those matters.
Yeah, there's a church I know of that once had one of the ruling elders that had a problem with another of the ruling elders in terms of a discipline type matter. And that actually just kind of ruled them out to be judges in that affair. And so they had to appeal to the session or to the presbytery because of that.
Scott has a note in our document. And since he's not in front of me at his computer at the moment, I'm going to read it because I don't know what it means. And maybe it'll be fun to see his reaction, where he just simply says, "This is not a teaching elder, good old boys club." If he wants to scamper back to his computer and offer an explanation for this, you're not scampering heartily enough, brother. I can't hear you. I don't know if
that's a really good point.
Yeah, man, that's excellent. Yeah, so good.
Yeah. I'm glad you can hear all that. When I go get some water, I go right outside of range for my AirPods. And so I didn't hear anything of you were talking about.
I was referring to the note you had underneath 13.9 that it's not a teaching elder, a good old boys club. I was wondering what
just
that meant.
Well, just to show that, all that means is that it is not merely a fraternal. The presbytery is not a fraternal just for the teaching elders who are friends to gather, meet, have some drinks, and have a good time. There is a gravity to the work that the presbytery is called to do. And it's not about protecting your own. It's about doing the work of the church well. And I think that's what it has power, and it breaks down all of those in the subsections, if you have your BCO out, of what that work looks like, which is substantial work, the corporate work of the church.
You have drinks at your presbytery meetings? Is that what you just said?
No. In Providence, they would go out after.
I didn't notice this, Scott. You put it in your notes, though, that there is some sort of arrangement of these following categories that we deal with: preparation and oversight of teaching elders from the presbytery standpoint, also oversight of congregations, and then oversight of the church at large. So we're just going to work through these section by section. You guys offer any comments, I'll jump in when I see something, and we'll just kind of cruise through these. So first, the presbytery has power to receive under its care candidates for the ministry, to examine and license candidates for the holy ministry, to receive, dismiss, ordain, install, remove, and judge ministers. Comment as you will.
So this is the general power. This isn't the detailed for what that looks like. And so it just tells you this is the power of the presbytery, one of the powers of the presbytery, and it relates to the credentialing of those who are within his jurisdiction. This will be further outlined as we get further in the BCO, and not too far from here, actually, as we see licentiates, candidates, ordination, dissolving relations, establishing relations. And so this will be much, you don't want to say too much in this section, because it will go at length when we get in the next few chapters, perhaps in the fall. But it is the presbytery's authority to credential those who are within its jurisdiction.
Secondly, the presbytery has power to review the records of church sessions, redress whatever they may have done contrary to order, and take effectual care that they observe the constitution of the church. So this is referring to review and control. If you've ever heard of a presbytery establishing a review of session records committee, I've been in presbyteries where we had that work designated to a permanent committee. I've seen it happen where it's a standing committee that's elected at every appointed rather at every meeting, and they meet over lunch and go through several books and then report back. You're supposed to look over the session records and make sure everything's okay. Some of this has come up in recent days, at different levels. Anything here you guys want to comment on?
I'm on this committee in Ileana. Ooh. And it is a lot of work, and we only have 12 churches. We're also tasked with visiting those churches. And so when we review their minutes, we fill out the form for their exceptions of form and substance. And then we basically hand deliver that to them if we're able, within their session meeting. And we ask, how can we pray for you, and, pastoral stuff. But that's the part of our task as a committee, to review the church, but also to get an update on the church's ministry. Some things perhaps that you wouldn't see in the minutes. And it is a laborious task, even to do 12. And so when you then blow that up to 88 presbyteries having their minutes reviewed, think of the substantial work of trying to review even four presbytery minutes. It's a lot of there's no hero's work here. You don't get congratulated for your great ability to review records, but it's important to the life of the church.
The presbytery has power, thirdly, to establish the pastoral relation and to dissolve it at the request of one or both of the parties, or where the interest of religion imperatively demands it. What are both of the parties involved in this relationship that they're talking about? And what's the significance of it?
Well, you have the teaching elder and you have the church, usually is what you are looking at there. You might have some sort of other agency as well, like RUF or something like that, but this is mostly looking at a church and a pastor relationship. And so you might have a church that is having a dispute with the teaching elder, and so the presbytery wants to be involved with that. Sometimes they part mutually, and that's fine, but if there's only one party that wants it, it's especially good for the presbytery to know what's going on. What's happened there, and to be able to settle something. I mean, if there was something that was wrong that was going on there, it shouldn't just be that the church let a pastor go. It may be that the presbytery actually needs to step in where the interest of religion is at stake there, because there's actually some other steps that need to be followed, especially for discipline.
What's the timeline on something like this? So if a man is resigns to move to a different work, when's his call actually dissolved? When's the relationship severed?
Say when the presbytery determines it. Just because you resign and the congregation agrees, or the session, if you're an assistant pastor, that doesn't mean that your call is immediately dissolved. It's the presbytery that establishes and dissolves pastoral relations, even for assistant pastors. And so when I resigned into Scumbia, it was received by the session in December, I believe, of 2022. I took my transfer exams in December. I had my floor exams in January, but I wasn't dissolved by Providence until February. And so it was a pending transfer. After you typically get the okay to move on the field when the receiving presbytery has done all its work and you sense there's no extraordinary circumstance from your local presbyterian why they would deny you, you can move in. But it's not done until all of the actions of the presbytery have finalized. And that's both the exiting presbytery, as you exit, they must approve it, and the receiving presbytery also approving it. And so you're not technically fully established in a church until all of those actions have happened. There are some informalities that go on with some of this as pastors move, but that's like the official side of things. You're pending until it's all finalized. And so you might, and if it's not an urgent issue, you might go out standing for, like I did, for 3 months. The request was made in December, it was fulfilled in February.
So there's a lot of moving parts in there. I mean, would you say that that in that interim period, you know, you've told the session you're going to be moving on, you have another thing lined up, where you were still expected and committed to maintaining your responsibilities in that call until the presbytery had dissolved the call, right? And you weren't moving on from that church until then.
Yeah, so the part of it, this is where there's some finesse and perhaps some informal parts of it. Though I resigned in December, I committed to continuing work through January. And so I was on active staff working throughout all of January. It was, a limbo period. You're working but packing and moving. But I worked maybe most of the month, maybe last few days we were actually moving. But the presbytery, there was no. In issues where there might be pushback in the presbytery, you would not want to move to the field too early. But if the receiving presbytery is already, you've already gone before them and they received you pending transfer, if you don't have any outstanding issues, you can likely move and there'd be no issue. But if there are issues, say you're escaping discipline or something, it would be a very poor decision to buy a house and move before that's finalized. And so, yeah, it's an interesting thing. Fred Greco's advice to me was, if you have no outstanding issues and the presbytery you're transferring to has received you and you're doing a normal call, then you can move after they receive you. And I think that's good advice.
The other side of this that you're speaking more to the departing, but you know, if listener, if you've ever served as an elder on an installation commission or if you're a member of a PCA church and you've had an installation commission come to your church and install a minister for you, that's what this is talking about, that the presbytery has the power to establish the pastoral relationship. So your pastor can't just show up after passing his transfer exams. The presbytery actually sends a group of men out who are appointed and empowered to take action as the presbytery and install the man in his particular call. They're establishing their a pastoral relation. Some of the greatest services that I've attended are ordination installation commissions, especially. It's a great reminder of our Presbyterian polity and the way that Paul worked in establishing these guys. Anyway, okay, I'm rambling. Let's keep going.
Does in that where the interest of religion imperatively demands it, does that also modify in establishing a relationship?
Ooh.
Like, I get that it could come by dissolving a relationship where it's just so toxic and corrosive that a presbytery steps in and dissolves it without the authority or approval of the local congregation. But is there a circumstance where you would establish?
I don't know. The way the grammar works seems unclear.
There's no like semicolons or anything, which would mean that it would be modifying perhaps both establishing and dissolving, though I don't know what tomfoolery you'd try with establishing a call against the congregation's will.
It is interesting. You know, we talk a lot about preliminary principles, right? And the body being governed, having the right to elect their governing authority and the men that are going to serve as elders. But this, you know, this actually gives sort of an exception to that rule that if there's a situation where religion imperatively demands a dissolving of a call, the presbytery is allowed to step in and make that decision and do it without asking anybody. You don't have to have the agreement of the parties. So this might actually be where we see some on one side, maybe the an exception to a preliminary principle, but also on the other side, it's kind of doubling down on some Presbyterianism in that the presbytery is the one responsible for pastoring and overseeing the teaching elder in particular, and can move him at will if they desire to in certain circumstances.
I think I'm going to overture the GA to add a single semicolon to
after pastoral relation.
Yeah. After C.
Oh man. Let's keep going. The presbytery has power to set apart evangelists to their proper work, to require ministers to devote themselves diligently to their sacred calling, and to censure the delinquent. Jared, what do you think? Scott and I have been rambling incessantly. Why don't you jump in and give us some thoughts here?
Well, this is just the presbytery's authority to set apart evangelists. And so,
how can a presbytery require ministers to devote themselves to their calling? What? And this might be something that we don't see a lot of as I read it. I start to wonder, if we need to establish this in our presbyteries.
This is partly discipline, but it could be in the level of encouragement. Maybe arrange some times at presbytery to encourage people in that and to help them with that, to pray for them in those matters. So there's a lot of things you can do short of discipline, but discipline, I think, would be a part of it as well.
Our preachers at our presbytery meetings usually are going to make application, you know, to ministers in particular. Sometimes it's by way of encouragement. I think that certainly fits into here. Of course, censuring the delinquent is pretty clear and obvious, but that's the other side of the coin.
If you have a pastor that is just not doing anything, they're not, they're recycling sermons, they're not doing any kind of visitation, they're not even showing up to session meetings, the presbytery has a right to step in and say, this is part of our charge duties that you're being delinquent here.
We keep going to see that the presbytery has power to see that the lawful injunctions of the higher courts are obeyed. Can y'all think of any particular way this is done or a situation you've seen where this has come into play?
You see it a lot in the assembly level to the presbytery as you're sending overtures back and forth and affirming a new standard or new articulations of our confessional system. And so you see it there. You also see it in the local level when you're having issues with a church, that if you thinking of review presbytery record or review of sessional records, or you're thinking of calling a minister, If a guy is rejected by a presbytery, the answer for the session is not to call him anyway, but to listen to the presbytery and why they've rejected the man for ministry, all of those sorts of things. If there's an issue going on with the church that they've done something unconstitutional, they've practiced something that's grossly unconstitutional, the presbytery must intervene and the lower court must listen.
This is one of the dangers, though, if you are having people in calls that are not PCA churches. So sometimes you'll have an independent church, they're doing pulpit supply or something like that. A lot of times they are subject to the whim of that church so that they don't have the protections that the Presbytery can say, you have to do this. But also the other way, we had, there's been instances before where a church has said, hey, we usually have a PCA guy come through here. Can he be examined for licensure, for ordination, and then be called kind of out of bounds to our church? And when we said, we don't think he's ready, the church said, yeah, we think he is anyway. And if the church isn't part of the PCA, then you can't really say anything about that. But if they are, then you can say, no, you can't call him and be a member in good
Good.
standing of our presbytery.
The presbytery also has power, F, to condemn erroneous opinions which injure the purity or peace of the church, to visit churches for the purpose of inquiring into and redressing the evils that may have arisen in them, to unite or divide churches at the request of the members thereof, to form and receive new churches, to take special oversight of churches without pastors, to dissolve churches, to dismiss churches with their consent. There's a lot being said here.
What I find interesting in this, and this probably needs amendments, but I won't recommend which ones. On the one hand, the presbytery must condemn erroneous opinions found within its jurisdiction at local churches. That means the presbytery does not have the liberty to not correct erroneous or grossly unconstitutional actions from a session. It must. But what I find interesting in this passage is that if the presbytery corrects the church and the church chooses not to heed that correction, the presbytery has no authority in its own right to dismiss the church without its consent. I find that to be an interesting balance. If a church continues to be derelict, like say they continue to, I don't know, have women elders or something, and they ordain them and they're unwilling to change, the presbytery, at least according to section F here, has no ability or authority to dismiss that church unless that church offers consent. And I believe there was a constitutional question on this, or some case, or as I was reading as I was reading some commentaries that were actually recommending that we should strengthen this section of the BCO. That you could admonish, but you have no more authority than that in redressing issues. You can declare an error, but you have no authority to remove the church unless they themselves want to leave. Am I reading that wrong?
It depends on how you read that semicolon, because it says to dissolve churches and then semicolon to dismiss churches with their consent.
And you've got a
So
whole
that.
section coming up on dissolving, right? That might. So you can dissolve a church without their consent, but you can't dismiss a church without their consent. Is that basically what we would say? The way it reads?
See, in the old main line, one of the benefits, and this is such a bad hot take, so take it as it is. One of the
I cut
benefits
barely anything anymore, so just it's staying in. Just be aware.
one of the benefits of the main line with the denomination owning the property is that the presbytery does have better accountability and authority over the local congregation. And that cuts both ways. If you have a bad denomination, it cuts terribly. Because they can really ruin your church, your healthy church's life. But it's the cost. It's the cost of having churches maintaining autonomy as it relates to owning the building. And again, that's why it's a bad hot take, is because you can't say that in the PCA and be okay. And I'm not advocating that the PCA own your church building, but one of the catch-22s that we deal with is because we don't own the church building, churches have a lot more latitude with how they exercise their own doctrine. And the presbytery has much more restrained accountability mechanisms to maintain that doctrine. If you own the property, you can just gut all of the bad leadership and take and assume control of that church. And again, I'm not advocating for us to own properties denominationally, but it is that's what you lose when you forfeit properties over to the congregation. You lose some authority, and that authority is this section right here.
There's a lot connected to that in our polity, the voluntary association of our denomination. Roy Taylor's got a whole thing out there that you can go, Google or find it on PCA History. I think he's got an opinion he wrote on the voluntary association and how it relates to legal connections too. But
The
it's
irony of that is
distinctive, yeah.
how we get around this in the PCA is we just tick people off so much until they themselves voluntarily leave. Like that's how discipline in the PCA works, whether it be Federal Vision or Side B or whatever controversy we're dealing with. You keep stirring it until I guess people say, you know what? I don't want to be with you people anymore. You're too toxic for me. And so we still do that. It's just not as clean and it's culturally messy.
I mean, maybe what we'd say, and we're about to talk about dissolving here in another paragraph or two, but the difference between dissolving and dismissing would be dismissing is obviously with consent is an agreeable thing. So you're not pronouncing anathema on a church when you're dismissing them. You're just agreeing to part ways. But dissolving a church in some circumstances might be because it's got some serious issues and it's time to get rid of it. I don't know. Maybe that's a hot take. Jared's just like laughing at us. Nothing to add. I think what Scott said at the beginning of this was great. This paragraph might need some amendment.
I don't know how you can dissolve a church without its consent. So I
You
might be a
can.
minority on here. I don't know principally if that works with the rest of the BCO. So.
Oh, I agree with you. I just think that our book reads as if we can do it without consent. Well, here we're not quite there yet. Let's keep going.
We can try
G.
that later this year, right? Now I'm forcing you to have to cut content.
Yeah.
Boy, I wasn't even going to
We'll find
listen to
out
this
there's.
episode before I published it, but now
All
I'm
right,
going to
so
have to.
you're cutting this content right here, but
Am
yeah.
I?
Well,
Okay.
Here you go. I'll help you.
That Scott's going to do right now.
So pretty much
Cut.
what I do is I watch it on the screen, and when there's a
Cut.
lot, well, when there's a bunch
Cut.
of us talking at the same time, I slow down and listen because I figure one of us has said, go back and cut the. But if we're just all talking for like a couple minutes at a time each, it's pretty smooth. I don't usually go and look at it.
I clap, so you'll see a nice spike in the recording.
G, the presbytery has power to devise measures for the enlargement of the church within its bounds. In general, to order whatever pertains to the spiritual welfare of the churches under its care. I mean, this seems pretty important to the work of a presbytery. You need to take care of the church, make sure you're moving along, planting churches, try to do this in accordance with the Great Commission, right? This is one of the big things the GA is given, but the presbytery has it in part as well.
Yeah, so this I think this is basically your M&A committee of your church. This is also your MC3 or whatever you call it committee, the ministerial care and a committee for churches that have things that come up that are not discipline level, but you need to have care in the church. So these are things that a presbytery needs to be doing.
It's good. And then H, the presbytery has power, and finally, to propose to the assembly such measures as may be of common advantage to the church at large. And correct me if I'm wrong, aren't we just talking about overtures in that particular case? So anything we want the assembly to do, the various ways we see overtures come before the broader body. So amendments to our constitution, statements that we want to take, commissions we want to form, study committees, etc. Let's keep going. Here's 1310. We've already referred to it a couple times, unless that material got cut in
It
editing.
probably does get cut.
Yeah, it probably has been cut already. When a presbytery determines to dissolve a church, it shall give no less than 60 days' notice of such dissolution to the local church. With such notice, presbytery shall communicate to the members their responsibility to transfer their membership to other particular or mission churches. In addition, presbytery shall transfer membership to existing churches with the consent of the individuals and the sessions of the receiving churches, or two, grant a letter of dismissal to an individual so requesting, testifying that the individual was a member in good standing of the church at the date of dissolution. Until such time as the person is received by a church, the presbytery shall continue to provide pastoral oversight. Or three, place individuals under the oversight of a commission of presbytery acting as a session for up to 1 year, renewable until such time as either a new congregation can be formed or such persons are dismissed to membership in another church.
This says that if you are dissolving a church, the presbytery still has responsibility over those people. And Good. So you can't just, it would be ridiculous just to dissolve a church and not do anything to transfer those members or to provide spiritual care for them, because that would be the equivalent of excommunicating an entire church. And you can't do that without process. So you have to do something with the members that are in that church.
That's a good
It'd
line.
Be almost unthinkable in my mind for a church or presbytery to ever do this.
1311, probably the least commentary on so many words we've ever had in the history of our show. 1311, the presbytery shall keep a full and accurate record of its proceedings and shall send it up to the General Assembly annually for review. It shall report to the General Assembly every year all the important changes which have taken place, such as licensures, ordinations, the receiving or dismissing of members, the removal of members by death, the union and the division of churches, and the formation of new ones. So this is pretty much transferring the same principle from sessions in chapter 12 to presbyteries in chapter 13. They got to send records up for review, and there's a list of things they have to keep track of. So for a session, it was stuff like adding and removing members, deaths, baptisms, things like that. And it's just a different list of things for the presbytery, licensures, ordinations, memberships, deaths, etc. What else here should we take note of? Yeah.
So this is something you'll hear more about, which is called RPR. We'll mm-hmm. refer to it as Review of Presbytery Records. That's the special committee that reviews the presbytery's minutes to make sure that they're doing things as they should.
They think they're special, but okay, that's fine. Oh, that was it. Okay. Lord willing, we're going to have Steve Tipton on in the near future to talk about RPR, especially as it works at General Assembly. So stay mm-hmm. tuned. A couple more paragraphs.
Sneakily the most powerful committee on the GA.
Ooh, hot take. All right. 1312. The presbytery shall meet at least twice a year on its own adjournment. The moderator shall call a special meeting at the request or with the concurrence of three teaching elders and three ruling elders from at least three different churches. Should the moderator be for any reason unable to act, the stated clerk shall, under the same requirements, issue the call. If both moderator and stated clerk are unable to act, any three teaching elders and three ruling elders of at least three different churches shall have power to call a meeting. However, any presbytery may prescribe its own rules in its own requirements for calling a special meeting, provided that those requirements are not less than those stated in this section. Notice of the special meeting shall be sent not less than 10 days in advance to each teaching elder and to the clerk of session of every church. In the notice, the purpose of the meeting shall be stated, and no business other than that named in the notice is to be transacted. The presbytery also shall convene when directed to do so by the General Assembly for the transaction of designated business only. Hmm. Okay. So, presbytery's got to meet twice a year. How often do y'all's presbyteries meet?
Four times a year.
We meet three times.
Yeah, we meet three times. So all of our presbyteries have taken it upon themselves to add to this rule a little bit more and require extra meetings. Sometimes you meet more than your stated meetings. So we have three stated meetings. We've had four or five meetings in a year previously from different reasons for called meetings that are described here. I don't know how you guys have called meetings very often. We don't. Once every few years.
Very occasionally. Yeah. Usually you have a called meeting if there's some sort of judicial matter that needs attention, or perhaps if there's somebody that needs to be examined and mm-hmm. ordained or installed, and the church can't wait the 3 or 4 months, or I mean, if this is twice a year, 6 months, if you're in that presbytery, until they would be able to move on to the field.
We had a presbytery meeting at General Assembly one time. We found a room for, you know, 45 minutes and got together and had a called meeting to transfer, basically just to transfer a man's call to a different church in the presbytery because they were in need of a pastor pretty quick.
Hmm. What I find interesting at the end of this section, it talks about the presbytery also shall convene when directed by the General Assembly.
Yeah.
And that is perhaps pertinent with the recently released Metro New York case where the SJC made a ruling to remit the issue back to the presbytery to address it adequately. And in that, it said you must report before the 51st General Assembly. And that means that they must meet and submit their work to RPR before RPR meets. And so there, the assembly through the SJC in this matter is basically commanding that Metro New York meet according to this provision, that they're calling them to meet, and so they must meet.
Yeah, a lot of this is pretty straightforward. We don't need to give you guys details on every little sentence here. Last paragraph of the chapter 13:13. There's got to be something fantastic about that. 13:13. Ministers in good standing in other presbyteries or in any evangelical church being present at any meeting of presbytery may be invited to sit as visiting brethren. It is proper for the moderator to introduce these brethren to the presbytery. This provision shall also apply to the General Assembly. Any comments on the visitors part? I think the last sentence is interesting, but we can talk about the first part first.
Just the general idea that though you would welcome visitors, they aren't commissioners to that body, and therefore they have limited actual privileges before that body unless those privileges are extended by the presbytery itself. And so my wife might visit, but she doesn't have the authority to speak on the floor unless granted by the presbytery to do so.
Yeah, we have people that will come from NAEPARC denominations. We've had Barry York from the RPCNA come before and talk to us about what's happening at the seminary that's nearby because there's some PCA guys that will go to RPTS. And so he comes and he sits for most of our meeting and hangs out with us, eats lunch with us. And this is kind of a nice provision to say that we can recognize some unity even across those denominational lines.
Anything else to say about chapter 13? This is a lot about presbyteries. We thought it might be one episode. You're probably listening to the second part right now as we speak, so don't worry about it. Presbyteries are good things. We like them. We're used to them. Anything you guys want to finish out on?
Presbyteries are an important help to the local church. This is not just the teaching elder goes off to presbytery and does whatever they do there, and we don't really care about it. This is important stuff, especially if your church gets in trouble. Your church needs help. Your church needs some spiritual help. Your church has a discipline matter. The presbytery then becomes a very helpful provision in our polity.
Well, as your presbytery clerk almost certainly would say, this podcast is over. Thanks for joining us. Be sure to come back next time when we get into BCO 14, discussing the General Assembly. And just a reminder to you listeners, we're going to be heading out of the BCO again after we finish chapter 14. We're going to kind of track through the schedule of the General Assembly. So we're going to talk about what happens each day. We've got guests coming on to discuss what's going on at General Assembly so that especially perhaps this first time around, we can address things that you might need to know as a first-time attender. So you get a good lay of the land for anybody that's coming for the first time. We're excited about that. And then after those several episodes, we're going to try to do some GA preview for you, maybe try to talk through some overtures, hopefully get some guys on to talk about the different sides of the issues, try to give you guys kind of a candid take on what's coming up in June. If you're interested in learning more about anything that we've talked about, be sure to look at our show notes in your podcast player or at politymatters.org. If you've enjoyed the show, consider following us on Twitter and Facebook at Polity Matters and subscribe in your podcast app of choice. If you've got questions or comments, you can contact us at politymattersfeedback@gmail.com. And you can find all of us on Twitter. The show notes have links to our profiles. You can go find them there. We've been encouraged by contact from some of you all lately. We are glad that our show's become a resource for you. I'm encouraged to hear about the work that's going on in churches in our denomination as the polity of our church is being taught more clearly. You guys are jumping in line with Witherow. We're going to preserve Presbyterianism for ages to come, I'm sure. We thank you again for spending your valuable time with us. Until next time, say goodbye, gentlemen.
Goodbye, gentlemen.
Take care.
Y'all take care.